Hello, everybody. Welcome to Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell, and today our guest is Aurelia Losa. She's a professor in the Department of Public Health Sciences at UT El Paso. And Aurelia, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you.
Now, we've not done very many people in health sciences, and so the audience is going to think, wow, that's a big area. But before we get into it, let's learn a little bit about Aurelia. How did you become a scientist? What were those moments when you grew up and where you grew up that made you decide a career in science was for you?
Well, initially I didn't. When I started my university education, I didn't know I was going to end up in a career in science. I studied math. I thought I was going
to
teach.
Well, hang on. You studied math, so, I mean, that's already putting you in a very special coterie of people in America.
And I studied math to teach math.
Ah.
So I knew I wanted to be a math teacher, math professor, math instructor of some kind. And partly because I had struggled with it so much, and I thought it should be made more accessible. So one of the areas that I where I learned about research was math education. That's where I was exposed to research, was learning about how you make math education more accessible to all the types of students that exist in a very multicultural environment like in California where I grew up.
I mean, do you have teachers in your family? Was there some background of mother, father, sister, uncle that was in this game?
Yes, my grandmother was a teacher, and she founded the first school in my parents' hometown in Jalisco, Mexico. She taught the men how to read and then the children how to read. And so she was an educator. The first school in a very, very small community.
Well, that's you must be very proud of that.
Yes, it was very inspiring to know her story.
Did you go back and visit this township?
Every few years, not as often as I'd like. It's still very rural.
So, in fact, then you come from a Mexican-American background.
Yes.
Were you born in Mexico?
No, I was the first of my family to be born in the U.S. I have 10 siblings. And
10?
10, and I'm number 9 out of 10, so I'm a statistic. And I was the first one born in the U.S., the first one born in a hospital, and the first one to go to college. So I was very different.
So you set an example. I mean, that's sort of an interesting, it's beyond this program, but do your younger siblings sort of look up to you, and have they attempted then to go to college after your example?
Not my younger sibling, but two older siblings did go back to college and finish degrees after I had finished mine. So I feel like I inspired the older ones, which is typically not the way it happens, right? You inspire the younger generation. But my nieces and nephews, who are about my age, a lot of them, if not all of them, have started a college degree or finished one.
Okay, so then you've got the example of your grandmother founding the first school in her township in Jalisco.
Yes.
Then you go and say, I want to be a teacher, I want to be a math teacher. So you went to study math.
I went to study math.
And you got a degree in mathematics. But somewhere along that line, something else came into your mind.
I was always exposed to professors, or I worked with professors who had, I didn't know it at the time, but they were activists, or they were working towards social justice. So I think that was something that was very attractive to me, or it's something I believed in, but I didn't know what it was, and I didn't see how it fit within math or the areas that I was studying. So it stayed as an interest of mine, social justice in general. So it was through education initially, making math accessible, understanding how math was a gatekeeper for other sciences, and understanding many other things, not just math itself. And so why wasn't it not accessible to everyone in the same way became something I was interested in, like gender biases in math education and how women were not as successful in obtaining higher degrees or achieving the same level in math when they graduated from high school compared to boys their age.
I remember reading an article that talked about this gender sort of issue with mathematics. And I don't know which university it was, but it was an experiment where they mixed men and women and taking, say, a GRE or something like this. And of course, because the statistics bear it out, the female population didn't do as well as the male population. But when they repeated this and said, now, we're not going to just test you for your math skills, but we really want you to help sort of answer these questions so we can devise better tests in the future. And they separated the men from the women. So they were all women taking the test or all men taking the test. The women, in fact, did better than some of the men in the test. So it's a matter of the, how would I put it, the environment as to how is the performance. Are you interested in that at all? I mean, is that some aspect of your sort of social justice? The environment you're in creates a different result from a different environment.
I definitely agree with that, but I didn't study that. That wasn't part of what I was able to look at when I was involved in curriculum development and understanding the tools that are used in a classroom setting that might be gender biased so that boys might feel more comfortable with those tools than girls based on how we're socialized and differently.
How long did you teach and how long were you involved in this teaching process?
I didn't teach very long at all. So after I finished my math degree, I went straight into a teaching credential program in California at the same university. And I was student teaching throughout that year. And I realized that the social justice component was something a lot more, it was beginning to mean a lot more to me. And I realized that I wasn't going to be able to see the impact that I wanted to see in the classroom. And so I learned that a lot of the way the education system was structured was based on policy issues that weren't being implemented rather than committed teachers. There were a lot of committed teachers and a lot of people who wanted to offer equal math education to everyone. That wasn't the problem. The problem is perhaps the books or more structural issues that weren't being addressed and that involved decision makers at a different level beyond what the teachers were involved with. So then I began to recognize that the way things were occurring in the classroom had a lot to do with policy and other bigger issues that I didn't understand, and I didn't really know how to be involved in that as a math major.
Right. So you decided to go to graduate school in some area where you could delve into this issue.
I didn't.
Oh.
So I went for a degree in statistics, and I wanted to make a career. And so I felt like social justice was something I was interested in, but I couldn't make a career out of it. I didn't know how you fit that into your life. And so I went for a degree in statistics, and I was trained in different statistical software and how to use data, and it was very applied. And I learned a tool that could be applied to many different areas. So I ended up in the insurance industry, risk management, finance, actuarial mathematics in that area for a few years. And I was teaching those courses, and I really liked it. But it was completely ignoring this other component that was always knocking and I wasn't addressing. So during that master's program, I focused on just being trained in these skills, analytical skills. And later I decided to move away from a corporate setting and move into a university research setting at a school of medicine.
And
that's where I made the switch to research as part of my career, actually being involved in research projects.
So social justice is an enormous field.
Yes.
I mean, you can think of math, you can think of healthcare, you can think of environmental issues. What did you choose to sort of concentrate on?
Again, I kind of put that in the back burner. It was something that I didn't realize how much it meant to me, but I didn't know how to link it. I didn't feel I was in a place where I can bring those two areas together, my training and what I was interested in as a human being overall, not just as a professional in a field. So I didn't see how to mix those two passions together or paths until I was in the School of Medicine, and I was a consultant, a statistical consultant, and my clients could be anyone from the School of Medicine. So I would work on cancer projects at the Cancer Center, Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. And my favorite projects were always the epidemiologists. They were working on social issues that involved humans, that involved making impact in communities. And I thought, who are these people that are doing this very different work from everyone else that would come in? And so I started attending talks, lunchtime talks. And becoming familiar with that science and really realized that that's exactly what I wanted to pursue my PhD in. Fortunately, I was at a campus where that degree was available to me, so I applied for the PhD program in public health epidemiology at the same university, and I was able to complete my degree there.
And so here you are with a PhD in public health epidemiology.
Mm-hmm.
So now you think about a career. After you've got your degree, you've got your training, you've begun to see your talent and your passion blending.
Exactly.
Right? And then you get a position at the University of Texas at El Paso, and you can say, hey, the future is how I design it, how I desire it also. So what did you choose? It's something to do with HIV, I believe, right?
Yes. Yeah, so I've continued my work from my dissertation project in Tijuana and Ciudad Juarez, working with sex workers and injection drug users and HIV prevention, as well as other sexually transmitted infections. So I didn't necessarily have this as a strong interest initially, but in attending talks and meeting people that were involved in these projects, I realized that that was definitely something I can commit my PhD work for the next 4 years. And so I was trained in that area. It wasn't an area that I was familiar with before starting my PhD, but it became something I found very interesting and also very important, and definitely tied with the social justice component that I had been longing to melt into everything else that I was doing.
Your knowledge of statistics, clearly epidemiology is nothing if it's not looking at big data and sort of making statistical analyses.
Exactly.
So tell us then what your first sort of project was when you got here. You obviously, what do you call them, sex workers on the border? Are they different in terms of a group to study than sex workers in Nevada or New York or Colorado? I mean, is there a difference because they're on the border?
Definitely. There's other issues that impact sex workers on the U.S.-Mexico border, such as migration or deportation from individuals that are in the U.S. and are deported to border cities where they don't come from. So they're deported in cities where they don't have a social network, and they become vulnerable to drug use or perhaps entering the sex trade.
Let me just interrupt there. So if you're an undocumented worker, regardless of whether it's sex trade or any other trade, and you are picked up by La Migra or whoever, ICE or whatever it is, mm-hmm. and then you're deported, they don't deport you into the middle. They just deport you right to the frontier.
Exactly. So they deport people to the border cities, not everyone, but in large, in certain moments more so than others.
Why?
They've deported them to the border. Well, perhaps it's less expensive. I don't know why that happens. But the fact is that it does, and it creates a marginalized or vulnerable population on the Mexico side of the U.S.-Mexico border, which are factors known to increase vulnerability to substance abuse and also entering the sex trade.
We have to take a break. This is Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Professor Roalia Losa from the Department of Public Health Sciences at the University of Texas at El Paso. We're talking about all sorts of interesting topics. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Norbert, do you recall when former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg tried to ban the sale of sugary drinks larger than 16 ounces?
Yeah, it started the Big Gulp Rebellion, even though the ban was overturned in the courts. But the truth is, too much sugar is making America fat. Although, how much is too much? Less sugar than you'd guess if a new finding on mice is also true of people.
In the study, a quarter of the calories fed to one group of mice came from sugar mimicking high fructose corn syrup, which in human terms is about 3 cans of sugary drinks a day. That describes a quarter of the U.S. population.
In the study, sugar-fed mice and mice on a normal diet stayed on those diets for 26 weeks. Then they were all released into a natural environment together, and the results were stunning.
Over the next 32 weeks, the sugar-fed female mice had a 2-fold increase in death rate compared to the control group. And the sugar-fed male mice produced a quarter less offspring and held a quarter less territory than male mice fed the normal diet.
These mice showed minor physiological differences such as increased cholesterol levels. But what is significant is how this diet produced such major life outcomes. Those mice had a shorter lifespan, lower reproductive and competitive success.
We may see similar studies in the future where scientists look for overall changes in quality of life, even when you don't find clear physiological changes.
A new nutrition guideline could be in our future, especially when you consider more than a third of us are obese. Perhaps former Mayor Michael Bloomberg was onto something after all.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell here with Professor Aurelia Losa from the Department of Public Health Sciences. And Aurelia Losa is trained as an epidemiologist. And we're talking about this problem that most of us don't even think about. When you have a border and you have undocumented people lurking in one country, they're deported back to whence they came, which in this case is usually Mexico, but they're just dumped right on the border usually or quite often. And that makes them very vulnerable. Mm-hmm. So take us through the stages of, I mean, these people don't start out as sex workers. Let's assume they're picked up in Chicago and they're dumped in El Paso or Ciudad Juarez, rather. How does that progressively move them into sex work?
Well, they might not have any money when they are deported to these cities, so they will resort to minimal services that are available to the deportees in each of these cities. I mean, these cities are receiving more deportees than they can handle, so the infrastructure isn't there to support them and to transition to whatever cities they need to get to. So then they're in a city where they don't have a social network. They don't have a support system. They don't have resources. They might not have money. They might not have identification. They don't have basic documentation that will allow them to move within the country. So they are. That's one of the factors that makes them vulnerable. There are other factors that make people vulnerable in the U.S.-Mexico border on the Mexican side. Many people come to the border cities, which offer more opportunities for work than perhaps their home towns or states. So there are people that migrate within Mexico to the border region. And again, they face similar vulnerabilities, such as not having a social network and not having a support system and also being vulnerable in that way.
So and the very fact they're on the border where there's more money in the northern side of the border and therefore more opportunity to be taken advantage of, I suppose, by the sex business.
Right. And this is true worldwide. Whenever people are displaced, they're vulnerable. And they're not only vulnerable to substance abuse or entering the sex trade. Those just happen to be the two areas that I work in because of my work with HIV.
Right.
And they are both high-risk groups for HIV. But there are many other factors that or many other outcomes that displaced people face throughout the world and here on the U.S.-Mexico border.
The HIV issue, I mean, what, 20 years ago, this was really an incredible dilemma. But the biomedical research has come to the point now that there are cocktails, medicinal cocktails, that are sort of making life for people with HIV more bearable. Do you see that reflected in attitudes to people in the sex business or outside of the sex business, to be more cavalier in their behavior because they think now there's medications out there?
That is one of the that is one perception, that now because there's medication, people are less worried about preventing HIV. In certain communities, that is something that is discussed. The problem is with, at least in the Hispanic community in the U.S., Hispanic community tends to be tested late, so they are already advanced or they've had HIV for some time. So the treatments are most effective when people are detected early. And in the Hispanic community, people tend to test later. So
and,
they're
and why
more advanced.
Is that? Is that simply economics?
It could
or
be
stigma.
It could be stigma. It could be not having access to healthcare. It might be believing that you're not at risk. And so what we're seeing in the U.S. as a trend is that the incidence or the new cases are now highest among the women of color who are heterosexual, perhaps monogamous, whereas before the incidence was highest among high-risk known high-risk individuals, such as injection drug users or men who have sex with men. So the face of who is affected by HIV is changing. It's not people that are traditionally thought of as high risk, and so they're not seeking treatment because they don't feel that they are at risk. The perception has changed, and so has the risk.
Let's change topics and get on to the transgender issue that is really one of your major areas of research. What is it that you're researching? What is it that you're trying to find out, and then presumably by finding out the issues, correct in a social manner?
Yes. Yeah, so another high-risk population for HIV is transgender women. And so I've had the opportunity to complete a small qualitative study among 13 transgender women living here in El Paso to find out what are their needs and where are the services that they might need so that we can disseminate that information within the community. And what I learned from that study is that there are no services for transgender women or transgender people in general currently in El Paso. Some of those services did exist at one point, and they were housed in agencies such as Planned Parenthood, but Planned Parenthood no longer exists here. So a lot of the services that were available and were inclusive to transgender persons are no longer available in El Paso. So what we have is we have a gap. And one of the needs...
Let me just interject there. Mm-hmm. Let's say a transgender woman has got some infection, and just like I get infections or we all get infections.
Right.
It's not so easy for them just to go to a regular GP.
Well, if they have access to one, assuming that they had access to healthcare, like they have insurance, even when they do arrive to a doctor's office, because of their presentation, their gender doesn't match their sex on the forms, they might be treated with some stigma or discrimination. They might face discrimination when they enter these clinics or hospitals because there's confusion about the gender or their sex.
That's interesting. So, I mean, have you thought about also, obviously you've got this small pool, an important pool of transgender people, but have you talked to doctors or hospitals about, do they have policies and are they making it possible or easier perhaps for these people to get attention?
Not yet, but we're working on that.
Right.
So here in El Paso, we've formed in the last year an HIV community mobilization team, which involves different partners in El Paso, including University Medical Center, and it's led by the City of El Paso Department of Public Health. So we meet every other month and we bring people representing hospitals and other agencies like schools and other agencies that serve different segments of the population, and how we can introduce sensitivity training into these areas. For example, there might be transgender children in the schools that might be facing perhaps stigma or are being bullied. In the school system, we need to have the conversation. We need to have the conversation with doctors and healthcare providers and help them understand how to be respectful and sensitive to the fact that someone who's transgender might come into their clinic. And yes, their name or their presentation might not match the sex on the form, and that's okay. And how do you deal with that? And
it's
how do
unusual,
you be respectful?
And I can understand the confusion, right? I mean, but you just mentioned something that never crossed my mind, transgender children. I mean, is that an issue in El Paso, or is it an issue nationally that is really up front?
Well, when someone is transgender, they might not identify with being transgender as a child because they might not know there's a word for what they're experiencing.
Right.
So because a child might not identify as transgender, it doesn't mean that they're not. It just means they haven't discovered or felt there's a vocabulary, a word, or
well,
a space
just,
for them.
Can you define transgender? Maybe I should have done this right at the beginning. I mean, I thought I knew, but perhaps I don't.
So a transgender person, for example, a transgender woman, is a woman who was born with male genitalia but identifies as a woman, as her gender. So the gender and the sex, their biology, don't match. And so a transgender man or a trans man would be someone who's born biologically female but identifies with being a man.
And so how does that sort of manifest itself? I mean, one of the issues, I suppose, it must be the problem of going to a public bathroom. This has got to be an issue.
It is. And for people and for trans people that are working and have jobs and don't feel comfortable using the bathroom according to their sex, but rather to their gender, are sometimes corrected by their employers or, you know, they might have problems because of that in their workplace.
And the fact that you've identified this important pool of, I think you said 13, right? Now, 13 seems to the average person listening in a city of 700,000, and perhaps you've got people on the other side of the border, so another 1.5 million. It's a very, very small grouping.
Right.
And the sheer small size, does that hinder really public attention being focused on their need?
The study was a qualitative study, so actually 13 is a reasonable sample size for a qualitative study, especially in the case in which we're learning what the needs are and what the resources that are available are in the community. So that sample size was appropriate for that study. However, it is a small number. And in general, it's understood that transgender people represent 1% of the population. So they are a small group within our population.
1%.
1%. But they face so many issues. They have higher rates of suicide, HIV. They're higher rates of being involved in sex work and higher rates of depression. But all of this is linked a lot of times to the fact that they're not accepted by their families. They have a hard time being accepted by them. By their own selves, because it's not something that we talk about openly and that we accept as a society yet.
Are there any societies where that is much more open?
There are. There are other societies. For example, in India, there's the Hydra.
In India?
In India, they have a third gender. So they identify the Hydra as an actual gender. And they have a place in society. They're involved in specific ceremonies or traditions. So there is a specific role that they fill in society. And then there's other countries where they're more open.
This has been an absolutely fascinating program. Let me ask you, after your study, what will be the outcome? Because this is you're having an impact right here in El Paso, Texas, but it can be duplicated elsewhere. What would you like to see after 10 years of your studies and understandings? What would be different here and elsewhere?
I think definitely one of the goals is to have a resource center or service center, community center of some sort that focuses on meeting the needs for the LGBT community, specifically the trans women living here, in terms of providing them with referrals to service providers and maybe other businesses that they might need to seek services from, who are sensitive and who are culturally competent to serve their needs.
And therefore their health would be better,
exactly.
Be less of, I suppose you could argue that would be self-interest for society, because a healthier society is a better society to live in. Right.
Exactly. And I've heard once, if you serve the most marginalized group of people in a society, you improve everybody else's health.
I think that's a beautiful way to finish off, because it's absolutely the truth.
Yes.
Absolutely the truth. Ralia Losa, professor from the Department of Public Health Sciences at the University of Texas at El Paso. It's been absolutely delightful to have you here. I've learned a lot.
Thank you so much.
And I congratulate you on a fascinating career.
Thank you so much
for being here. And Norma Martinez, thank you also for putting the program together. And I'd like to thank the listener out there. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Texas Tech's Gail Grieve Hunt School of Nursing in El Paso had a topping out of the last steel beam on its new building. The January topping out marks the interior phase of construction. The facility is slated for completion in October. The building marks another advancement for the Medical Center of the Americas campus. Read more at mcasynapse.org. Support for Synapse comes from Sierra Providence Health Network.